You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.
The book is 10 years in the making. Investigative journalist Leslie Kane joins me on the program. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you've written this book. Tell me first, what I'd like to know. I saw you were a guest on the Colbert Report with Stephen Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting. I've watched that interview now online three times, and it's very interesting how he approached it. Excuse me, of course, as a comedian, but also in a sense asking every dumb question that you must get. You got them all. And it was quite demonstrative, I think, about what the larger culture, how the larger culture reacts to a book like this and even research like this.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think he's very good at sort of reflecting, you know, current sort of knee-jerk reactions to things. And what's also great about those kinds of questions is it actually brings out the information that you want to have come out. And it can even show sort of the foolishness of some of the concerns that people have. So I was really, I mean, I thought he was really terrific, and I was happy with the questions. I thought he's really smart. I'm a fan of his. So, you know, I agree with you. I think the reflections that came through him are concerns that a lot of people have. The point he made about he hopes they're not, that this isn't real because he won't be the most important thing in the world anymore.
Right.
You know, I think people have concerns like that. I mean, they don't want to deal with some phenomenon out there that could be all powerful, that they, you know, we're no longer the top of the food chain and all of that. I mean, I think people, so he kind of reflects back fears that people actually have, concerns that they have. I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And when he said, you know, God forbid the aliens are Muslims, I mean, he's trying to be funny in it. It was a funny joke. But I guess the larger point is the fact that there is real genuine fear for a variety of reasons on the part of a lot of people when we start talking about UFOs.
Absolutely. And of course, the point I'm making in the book, though, is, of course, that we don't yet know what the UFOs are. I mean, UFOs means unidentified flying objects. So, you know, I think it's important that people don't jump to conclusions about what they are. I mean, it's certainly a possibility that they're extraterrestrial, and a lot of very high-level people have proposed that possibility, but we don't know for sure. So let's hold off on too much reaction until we actually get an investigation going and find out more about them.
We're honored to be talking with investigative journalist and author Leslie Kane. Her new book is UFOs, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070 if you have a question or a comment for Leslie. And we'll also be giving away a copy of her book here at the end of this interview. Who is this book for? I've heard you say in another interview that this book is for the folks who don't normally buy UFO books.
Yes, I mean, that's who I was hoping, you know, that's who I designed it really for. I mean, it's for everyone, but what I was trying to do in this book is actually bridge the gap between the people that are already interested in UFOs, which is a lot of people, to the people that are the bright, skeptical people who normally would never read a UFO book. I mean, this is the book that they might pick up and read. It's sort of a tool to try to break that barrier that's out there, to try to change the taboo status of the subject, and to reach people that are in a position to create change within the society. And I think it presents the kind of information that can do that, because there's nothing speculative about it. We're not claiming anything. We're very sober, but also providing really, really exciting and information that nobody can argue with. So I just hope it can be used to, you know, to reach a group of people that normally would scoff at this or just wouldn't be interested at all.
We're talking with Leslie Kane. The new book is UFOs. Leslie, it strikes me as quite medieval that the larger culture reacts to the free inquiry that you're calling for, a real, you know, nonpartisan, you know, well-funded investigations into this phenomenon. It strikes me as something out of the Middle Ages for most people to instantly want to shut this down or deride it or ridicule it.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It sort of reminds one of the situation with Copernicus, you know, hundreds of years ago. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing. Any kind of scientific revolution throughout history has always been met with lots of resistance. And Copernicus was absolutely right when he said that the Earth was not the center of the solar system, but the planets revolved around the sun. But nonetheless, he was placed under house arrest, and it took hundreds of years for his views to be accepted. So, I mean, you're right. The word medieval, it's primitive, and it's very irrational, and it's kind of a knee-jerk response, I think, to very serious data. But I also think a lot of the problem is that most people have not looked at the data yet. And I hope this book will provide an opportunity for them to really look at it for the first time. It's hard to, you know, so it's a conglomeration of issues, but it's primitive. I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, irrational is a word that comes to mind.
So let me give you an opportunity. Take an opportunity now and just talk at length if you want and share with us what we do know. And again, just to underscore your first point, when we talk about UFOs, we are talking literally about unidentified flying objects. Things are reported or seen, heard in some cases. We're not talking about aliens necessarily. We don't know that.
Absolutely right. And I, you know, that point is made very clearly in the book. And I think that's one reason why this book, you know, is powerful and can reach people, that the kinds of people we've been talking about. What this book really establishes without a doubt, and I absolutely clearly without a doubt, that there is some kind of physical phenomenon in the sky. It is seen all over the world, and it's physical, and it has all kinds of capabilities that we cannot explain, that our physics cannot explain, such as, you know, extraordinary speeds, extraordinary maneuverability, being able to stop in midair and then suddenly take off at the blink of an eye, accelerations that would kill any human being who was inside something like this, brilliant lights, you know, way much more powerful than anything we have in the sky. There's just, you know, and it's consistent. It's been going on for decade after decade after decade. And we cannot explain how the technological, the observations that we've made of how these things behave, we can't explain how that's even possible. And without a doubt, we don't have the capacity to do the kinds of things that they do. So that alone, in my opinion, as a journalist, is absolutely extraordinary that we have the data to show that such a phenomenon exists. We don't have to go beyond that and say that they're alien, because we really don't know, as you said, but just that very point is extraordinary, and we have case after case and source after source in the book that make it very clear that this is the way it is. There are five generals who have written for the book, and these people are writing their own pieces. I mean, half the book is written by me, and half the book is written by these authorities in their own words, their own pieces, speaking directly to the reader. So you're getting a firsthand, you know, account from them. Some of them are witnesses who have been involved in extraordinary Air Force encounters with these objects. They've actually tried to shoot them down. And they tell the reader their own stories of what they felt, what it was like for them to be up there facing this phenomenon, what it was like when their weapons became disabled at the last minute and they couldn't shoot. I mean, it's very personal. And the level of detail that this book brings forward has never occurred before. I mean, some of these people may have spoken very briefly before, but never like they are here, and never, you know, with their own, with a carefully written piece. So anyway, that's sort of my spiel about the book. I mean, I think the material that it, the point that it makes is extraordinary in itself, and you don't have to embellish it in order to make the point. And it also has a lot more power when you don't embellish it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you just joined us, we're talking with investigative journalist and author Leslie Kane. Her new book is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, share with us, if you can, one or two of these stories that you got for the book and got on the record for the first time that the public may not have known about, a story that really jumped out at you as you were hearing it for the first time.
Wow, well, that's hard to say because so many of them did. And as I said, I mean, some of the stories, it's not like no one's ever heard of them before, but they've just heard little tiny bits. One of the cases that absolutely blows my mind is the Belgian Wave, which is presented at the very beginning of the book. It was a series of sightings over the country of Belgium in the 1989, 1990, repeatedly. And the major general who was the head of the investigation for the Air Force in Belgium, he was a colonel at the time, has actually written a piece for the book describing what it was like for him to be in charge of that investigation. And there are just so many fascinating witness accounts that he brings forward with drawings. And there was also an extraordinary photograph taken of one of these objects, highly analyzed through three or four different laboratories. You know, he tracked it down, he spoke to the photographer, thoroughly vetted, and it's an absolutely gorgeous close-up picture of a UFO. And when you just read a major general, you know, describing the effort he made to identify these things, going to the highest levels of other NATO countries, to the American government, making inquiries everywhere, and, you know, sending up F-16s also. They did that on three occasions to try to learn more about them. They were not able to figure out what these things were. And you have to assume that they probably weren't from this planet if he couldn't figure it out. And the whole country was mobilized in this effort, too. Very different than the United States. When the United States, you know, is confronted with something like this, it ignores it and wants to avoid it. And that's one of the interesting things about the Belgian case. It provides a very clear contrast with how the United States handles similar incidences over here. That country handled them very responsively and was held press conferences, informed people about what was going on, and was willing to acknowledge that they couldn't identify the objects. So as we all know, that kind of thing doesn't happen in the United States.
And I was going to ask you, it sort of leads to my next question, in whether it's journalism or history, what often is most important is not so much what's said or what goes recorded, but what's not said and what doesn't go recorded. And in the case of UFOs, the silence on the part of the U.S. government really speaks volumes, don't you think?
Absolutely agree with you. It's a really astute observation. And, you know, an example of that, a very recent case, was the Chicago O'Hare incident. And, it's just sort of an example of what you just described. I mean, if you compare this to what happens in other countries, there was a metallic-looking disc hovering over the United Airlines terminal in 2006, only a few years ago, at rush hour. And lots of United Airlines employees saw it, including pilots, and reported it on their radios and to the tower. And there's all kinds of tape recordings and discussions that took place while they were watching this thing. And then it suddenly shot up through the clouds extremely fast from a hovering position and cut a clear hole in a cloud bank right above where it was hovering over this terminal. And, you know, the response of the U.S. government, which is what we're concerned with here, was to completely ignore it. The first thing it did, and it was the FAA that was in, you know, that people went to ask for information about this, it first said that this object was lights reflecting off the clouds. It was the airport lights that had been turned on. And, of course, you had sophisticated aviation people who were reporting this thing. I think they know what lights look like on clouds. But it turns out, even after the FAA said that the lights weren't even on yet because it was too early in the day for that to happen. I mean, it was daylight. Second, so they made another attempt. The second attempt they said it was weather. And again, there are instruments at airports that measure the weather. People on the ground know what different kinds of weather problems look like. So, and that was so unacceptable that I went back. A few months later, I called up the FAA spokesperson who had made that statement about weather, and I asked him, what kind of weather were you talking about? Can you be more specific? And he said, and this is what I thought he would say, it was most likely something called a hole-punch cloud, which in a nutshell is a rare phenomenon that occurs when there's a hole in a cloud because ice crystals are dropping into the cloud from above. It sort of melts some of the cloud and you get this round hole. And it turns out, because I then went to some climatologists and physicists and weather experts after I spoke to him, and found out that this phenomenon of a hole-punch cloud can only occur at freezing temperatures or below freezing temperatures. And at O'Hare Airport that day, it was well above freezing. So it was literally physically impossible for the explanation that he offered to have occurred. And yet that's all that happened as a result of this case. No other comments were made, no investigations were conducted, and none of the witnesses at O'Hare Airport would put their names on the record, not one, because they were concerned about their jobs and about ridicule. So that's in a nutshell, is a metaphor for what goes on in the United States. I mean, that happened.
Yeah.
But that's an example of how the United States responds to events that happen here.
We're honored to be talking with author Leslie Kane. Her new book is UFOs. And this, we don't see a similar reaction when things like this happen in other countries.
No, and that's just such a striking situation. And I described Belgium, but we have, we've looked at cases. The book has writers from France. We look at cases from France, Brazil, Chile, the UK. I mean, all of these countries, when there's a situation that happens where there's some kind of object, let's say at an airport, or it affects an aircraft, or a pilot sees something and passengers see it and it's on radar, you know, these kinds of cases happen all the time. These other countries simply state that they cannot identify what happened, and they will release the information about what happened. It's covered in the media. The BBC will do a story about it. And there isn't this sort of ridiculous, pretending that it's something that it wasn't, which is really insulting to the witnesses.
Or eventually what we're doing is pretending that not that it was something that it wasn't, but that it didn't even happen.
Or that it didn't even happen.
That there was no phenomenon.
You're absolutely right. And, it's really interesting, and I've made that comparison throughout the book. I think readers are going to be amazed to see the differences. I mean, you're right, between other countries and America. And it's really time that America sort of, join the world community here and stop playing these games. I mean, that's really what we're asking for.
So we really don't have to
have a, go ahead.
Yeah, so we really don't have to wonder then, is there a cover-up? We know there's a cover-up when we see a reaction like this as to what happened in Chicago in 2006.
Yeah, I mean, and it depends if you want to use the word cover-up. I mean, that's sort of a loaded word. There's certainly a lack of investigation and a sort of ignorance and, an ignoring of things that happens. Now, whether there's an active cover-up or not, I mean, that's open to debate. Some people believe that there's a deep, dark kind of conspiratorial cover-up that's orchestrated within the government. Other people think, well, the government really doesn't know what this is anyway. They're as baffled by it as we are, and they don't really want to go out there and say, geez, there are these things flying around that we can't protect ourselves from. They're really advanced, and we can't do anything about it. That's also a possible scenario, that they just don't want to have to acknowledge something like that. We don't really know for sure. I mean, since I'm approaching this as a journalist, I have to say we don't have the proper kind of documentation to determine exactly what's going on behind the scenes within the U.S. government. But the bottom line, we know what actually happens, and that is that there is no investigation. They do everything they can to ignore what's going on, to not comment about it, and to just turn a blind eye. And, and that has to change. So regardless of what's orchestrating it or why it's happening, it's just obviously not acceptable, and that's what we're advocating for in the book, that something change, that we have a new agency within the government that can deal with this phenomenon properly, and that it liaison with other countries around the world who are already responsibly investigating these events.
Really quick here before we break for news, and mm-hmm. Can you stay with us through the news break?
Yes.
Great.
Until 5:45, right?
Yeah, we're talking with Leslie Kane. Her new book is UFOs. And really quick before we break here, would a new Project Blue Book type of investigation suffice, or does it need to be more than that?
Absolutely not a Project Blue Book type of investigation. There were a lot of mistakes made there, and we don't want to repeat the problems of Project Blue Book. Definitely not. And we can talk after the break if you want. Our proposal is for a very different kind of an office to be set up, modeled more on what's going on in France. Because nobody wants to repeat the problems of the ridicule and the secrecy and the irresponsibility that went on in Project Blue Book. So that's something we got to be careful about.
About 95% of UFO sightings can be explained as ordinary phenomenon. However, within that remaining 5%, spectacular, very well-documented UFO events have been officially investigated and no conventional explanations were found. The new book is UFOs. Generals, pilots, and government officials go on the record. Investigative journalist and author Leslie Kane joins me on the program. Leslie, before we broke, we were talking about Project Blue Book. Remind us what that is and what was wrong with it.
Well, Project Blue Book was the Air Force, actually, an Air Force agency that was set up back in around 1951. It had some other names prior to that, but it was basically an agency set up within the Air Force to receive reports of UFOs, to investigate UFOs, and to kind of serve as a public interface, a place where the people could go to file reports. based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it was in place until early 1970 when it was shut down, and there's a long story around that. But the bottom line is, I mean, the Project Blue Book was basically kind of a public relations effort, you know, public relations operation. It didn't do a very good job of actually providing answers to cases. It would often, you know, and again, all the files have been released, so we can see this by looking at the files. It would just label a case as something, you know, sort of like what we were saying at O'Hare. Maybe not quite that bad, but it would just say, oh, it was the planet Venus, or it was this or that. Very easily kind of give a label to a case without clearly really investigating it. And it was just a way of sort of managing all the information. There were a lot of different staffers that, you know, were rotated in and out, and it just didn't do the kind of job that should have been done. And J. Allen Hynek, who was the consultant who was with the Project Blue Book, he was from Northwestern University, an astronomer throughout its whole life, was sort of the one constant factor there who was very, very much a debunker himself when he began the job, and over the years came to see that there really was something going on here. And after the close of Project Blue Book, he wrote some really important books about what the UFO phenomenon actually was, and it was sort of the whole evolution that he went through. And he was one of the people that criticized Blue Book, and he knew from the inside the limitations of the organization. So there was no question that it was extremely limited and possibly even detrimental. So what we hope to have today is some kind of office within government, again, very small, inexpensive, but something that will have a board that would work with it from outside of government, composed of retired military people, scientists, you know, longtime investigators of the phenomenon, qualified people who could sort of guide and work with whoever the staff person is within the agency to be very sure that we don't repeat the same problems that we had before. So, and we're hoping that we can just get something like that set up. And that really tells you the story of what happened back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
It was a real problem, even though there was a lot of great positive stuff going on. It was sort of like the golden age of UFOs, really, in the 60s. There was just so much interest in it. It was all over the media. There were congressional hearings. There were many books and cover stories in magazines. And it was a major part of sort of, you know, the ongoing discussion within America. But Project Blue Book was a problem.
We're talking with author Leslie Kane. The new book is UFOs, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. We'll give away a free copy of her new book in just a few moments. Leslie, what are your thoughts about the incidents of the lights in Phoenix in the 1997, March of 97 was the first reporting? And the reason I ask is two reasons. Number one, I'm particularly fascinated by these sightings that involve thousands of witnesses, not somebody in a truck out in the woods, but, you know, very urban areas where there are hundreds or even thousands of witnesses and multiple photographs and video, very well documented. With some of these incidents involve news teams, TV news teams that are out recording it. That's of interest to me, as well as the fact that it's been called the Phoenix Lights from March of 97, but there were also that same incident involves seeing aircraft as well, slowly moving through the sky, the size of football fields, not very far off the ground. And yet that's not really mentioned all that much. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The Phoenix Lights, the name, the Phoenix Lights, is really kind of not accurate in terms of a description for the event, which, as you say, lasted a long time. It was about an hour and a half from about 8:30 to, let's say, from about 8 to 9:30 at night, where these gigantic, slow-moving objects were seen, you know, all over the state of Arizona, going from north to south. And as you said, assumedly thousands saw them. I mean, that's what the experts say who were on the ground then, because hundreds and hundreds of calls were made and reports were filed, and they were seen so widely. So it was just kind of one of these massive sightings, as you described, and they are really spectacular when these kinds of things happen. We had something similar to that in upstate New York in the 1980s that happened in the Hudson Valley. The Belgian case that I was describing earlier was very similar, where you just have so many witnesses that, you know, there is absolutely nothing anybody can say. It turns out that there were some flare drops that night, of course, and that was after the objects were seen at around 10 o'clock, which has sort of complicated the whole thing. But we can definitely separate that particular incident from the reports of what people saw earlier. And one of the interesting things in my book, I think, about this that's new is that Governor Feist-Symington has, who was governor at the time, has come out and acknowledged that he himself was a witness to the event. And he's in my book, he's talking a lot with a lot more openness about why he didn't say that in the beginning and what made him change his mind now and why he thinks it's important that we change policy. And it's really fascinating to hear from a high-level official who was also a witness who was actually trying to hide that fact at the time and now is very open about it. It's a particularly interesting element of the Phoenix Lice case, as far as I'm concerned, to have him involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Leslie, tell us where most Americans are familiar with the Roswell incident. It's been much discussed and almost mythologized, I would say. But tell us what happened in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania in 1965.
Okay, and I'm happy to do that. And this is something I worked on again for many years before even getting, you know, before doing the book. There was something that came down in Kecksburg in 1965. It's a small village southeast of Pittsburgh, and it was a kind of an acorn-shaped craft that was that made controlled turns before it landed. So we know that, you know, it wasn't just something that sort of fell. It seemed to, you know, because it's been mapped out. Again, a lot of people saw it, and so the researchers were able to map out exactly its trajectory, and it made turns, and it finally hit the ground. And within, you know, a very short time, the military came. They cordoned off the area. Hundreds of civilians heard about it on the radio and TV, and they all drove down to where the nearby where the site was to try to catch a glimpse of what was going on. And nobody was allowed anywhere near the actual landing site of the thing. And then at about 1, this happened around 5 in the afternoon, by about midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, around that time, the thing was removed on the back of a flatbed truck. It was covered up with a tarp, and a lot of people saw it zooming away. It was an army truck. So there were so many people that saw various stages of this event, from the actual landing of the thing. Some people saw blue kind of sparking lights and smoke coming out of the woods where it landed. Other people actually got right down to where it was and saw it close up before the military came in. Other people saw it when it was taken away. So there just is a huge volume of witness reports on this. And the Air Force said that it's basically, there was a file on it in Project Blue Book which stated that nothing came down that night. It was a meteor. End of story. So anyway, this is a fascinating case. There's a researcher named Stan Gordon who's been working on it ever since it happened, and I teamed up with him and tried to get a lot more government information about it. We filed a lawsuit against NASA. There's information about this on my previous website, which is freedomofinfo.org. But we filed a lawsuit against NASA, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. We got lots of documents released, but none of them actually explained what came down in Kecksburg. So it's still a mystery. And I'm sure it's classified high enough that we still aren't being told what it was. And it's hard to imagine why, after all these years, more than 40 years, there would be any need to withhold information about it if it was some kind of experimental, you know, craft of ours or the Russians or something like that.
Yeah, well, so, that's exactly where I was going. If it is us, then why not come out and say now, oh, by the way, yeah, we know that was we were testing something and it went awry.
You would think. And, you know, we've done so much research. We know anything Russian, we know it wasn't Russian because we have records of everything Russian that comes into the atmosphere. And I've talked to high-level people at NASA who have told me that we track all that stuff. And they one of the leading experts on orbital debris in the world checked the trajectory of this thing in Kecksburg, of what we, you know, in terms of when we know it landed, compared it to the Russian satellites that were around, and we know one that came down earlier that day. He said it could not possibly have been a Russian object. So the only real other option is that it was some kind of secret American experimental craft. Maybe it did some kind of damage. It was, you know, that they're worried about disclosing it. I really don't know, but you're right. Why after 40 years and, you know, all this intensive effort on behalf of citizens to find out what it was, why not just let us know if it was an experimental craft?
Leslie, do some previous, like, American test flights, say, you know, the stealth bomber before that was made public, or do those come out to be, oh, well, yeah, that must be what we have seen before. It was just the stealth bomber, or, you know, we know in retrospect that we were seeing our own test flights.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, you know, lots of UFO sightings, as you stated earlier, can be explained. And one of the things that happens is people will see these advanced test aircraft that are being tested. And then later on, you know, if they have a very clear description of it or a photograph or something, they are able to figure out, oh, yes, Now that we know that this thing is, we know that that's what we saw. And I'm sure there are lots of UFO sightings that where people will report something unidentified that are tests, you know, are advanced technology being tested. There is no way that that explains, of course, the cases that we have presented in the book. I mean, it cannot explain the totality of the evidence that we have of this physical phenomenon that's happening all over the world, but certainly some of the things that people see can be tracked back to that without a doubt.
Leslie Kane, the new book is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Coy, I really appreciate being with you. Thanks for having me.
This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.